between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the privilege of being joined by University of Victoria Emeritus Professor Nancy Turner. Professor Turner is an ethnobotanist whose research integrates the fields of botany and ecology with anthropology, geography, and linguistics, among other disciplines. She's interested in traditional knowledge systems and traditional land and resource management systems of Indigenous peoples, particularly in Western Canada. Nancy has worked with First Nations elders and cultural specialists in Northwestern North America for over 50 years, collaborating with Indigenous communities to help document, retain, and promote their traditional knowledge of plants and habitats, including Indigenous foods, materials, and medicines, as well as language and vocabulary relating to plants and environments. Her interests also include the roles of plants and animals in narratives, ceremonies, language, and belief systems. Dr. Turner has authored, edited, and co-authored or co-edited over 30 books, and her 2014 two-volume opus, Ancient Pathways, Ancestral Knowledge, Ethnobotany and Ecological Wisdom of Indigenous Peoples of Northwestern North America, represents an integration of her long-term research. She has received numerous awards for her work, including the membership in the Order of British Columbia and the Order of Canada, honorary degrees from Vancouver Island University, the University of British Columbia, University of Northern British Columbia, and Simon Fraser University. And she received the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences Canada Prize in Social Science for her Ancient Pathways work. Professor Turner, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
It's my great pleasure, Darren. Nice to be with you.
It's truly an honor to have a chance to talk to someone who's dedicated their life to such fascinating, and I think really at this point in the crossroads of where human society is, really necessary research into other ways of being and other lifestyles that existed long before modernity with a very successful track record. So I'm really excited to speak with you and learn more. But I do like to start off every episode with a little insight into how you got to where you are today. As best as you can over such an amazing career, give us some of the highlights or just that series of events that led you to becoming interested in this work and kind of set you on this path.
Okay, well, I should mention that my grandfather and my father were both entomologists. My grandfather got his PhD at Harvard specializing in ants. And my dad specialized in bark beetles and was getting his PhD in Berkeley where I was born. We moved to Missoula, Montana when I was a baby, and I spent my early memories of childhood there in Missoula, in the hills above Missoula, running around the woods with my sister Jan and picking strawberries and chokecherries and what we call sarvis berries and mushrooms. We made
of course
mushroom gardens. You know, we were just out in the woods all the time, in the aspen trees, the ponderosa pines. And that's, I think, where I got my very early love of plants and being outdoors in the environment. When we moved to Victoria when I was 5, I was already so interested in all of these things. My dad especially, but my mom as well, were very outdoorsy. And so we spent a lot of our time camping or cooking bannock over the fire, going out mushroom picking. I remember as just a kid, we'd go out for shaggy manes and lactarius and the other mushrooms that my parents knew. I was always interested too in how people use these things, how not just eating them, but making dyes and making string out of things. I was always doing that as a kid. I joined the Junior Natural History Society in Victoria, and Freeman King, who was the leader of that group, was very supportive of my learning journey. By the time I was in high school, I heard about this field called ethnobotany, and I decided that's what I wanted to do. So by the time I started university as an undergraduate, I went in for botany and also took anthropology. And I actually did my undergraduate thesis working with the Saanich and other Coast Salish peoples of Vancouver Island. Wonderful, generous people who were great teachers, especially Christopher Paul from Sartlip. He was what I call my very first teacher. And so once I got started on that path, it's one of those areas that the more you learn, the more fascinating it becomes. And I just wanted to continue on that path, which I've done for my whole life.
Well, and you're learning from cultures that are, I mean, some of the oldest cultures on the planet. And so many times I'm struck by this insight that I think Juliana Ferci put beautifully on one of the interviews we did with her, just saying that all the new discoveries that we're going to make when it comes to fungi, and I think you could extend this to plants and the uses, are really going to come from knowledge in the past. I mean, do you find that to be the case? And that there's really this infinite kind of wealth of knowledge we can pull from past First Nations and Indigenous peoples' knowledge of plants and fungi?
I think there is. And I think part of that knowledge comes with this close relationship that people have with plants and fungi and animals as well. The detailed knowledge that comes from long-term observation and teachings that go over generations. I think that's one of the characteristics of this kind of knowledge. It's based on very close observation and a different kind of relationship, really, that people have with their environments than many of us in mainstream society have.
Well, and I think that's something that so many of us are looking to now as an answer to maybe address some of the ills that we see in a society led by kind of modernity. But to get at the heart of this, you just brought up a big concept that I think you can elucidate maybe better than most, but a big concept that I think you're very well qualified to talk about, which is understanding that worldview. And I know in your case, you're speaking mostly about Northwestern North America, the tribes and indigenous peoples from there. But if you can give us a synopsis, because it's a massive topic, but that worldview and how things like epistemology and language play into how these cultures and peoples within them saw the world, maybe saw ecology and understood ecology and humans' place in it. Massive topic, but as best you can, give us some background on that perspective.
Mm-hmm. The worldview of indigenous peoples, I won't claim that I know about all indigenous peoples, but in general, there's a worldview that's been termed kincentricity, and that is that indigenous peoples hold a view of relationships with other non-human life forms, that these are our relatives, and they attribute similar qualities to what we humans have to other species, and things like being aware, having insight, and that kind of thing. And that's reflected in the stories and the ceremonies that Indigenous peoples have that go back for countless generations, since the beginning of time, you could say. And a lot of the perspectives about these life forms are embodied within the language that people have, the language of kinship that they have. So language is extremely important in terms of understanding. There's some concepts that we don't really have words for in English or probably in French or German, but are only found in these indigenous languages. And so it's really important to recognize that we can't learn all these languages ourselves, but to recognize that they embody ideas and concepts that aren't easily expressed in other languages.
There's so much encoded within a language in terms of what a culture is about and how people see the world. And I know from reading your bio and your work that that's something you've studied very in depth. I guess just on that piece, do you find a lot of differentiation between languages, or do you find echoes of kind of that kincentric epistemology throughout languages of different peoples that you've researched and worked with?
From the groups that I've worked with and collaborated with, there's a commonality of perspective that I see reflected in people's stories and their ceremonies and their languages. I can't speak for all indigenous peoples around the world, sure. But certainly that seems to come across. And in the area that I have spent most of my time in, which is Northwestern North America, there are about 50 different languages and major dialects spoken. And some of these languages are closely related, like those maybe 20 languages in the Salishan language family, or there's the Athabascan language or Dene language family. But there are also languages that are not related to any other that we know of, like Haida and Tanaha, the Kootenai language. But in any case, the languages, if you look at them, they reflect a sharing of knowledge across these languages and language families. Part of the shared knowledge comes from the ancestral peoples who then spread out on the land and carried that knowledge of the ancestors with them, no matter where they settled. So you have very similar themes and stories and knowledge among the Salishan peoples from Vancouver Island to Montana and in eastern BC, the Shwetmuk and
incredible.
So forth. But even across the language families, you have examples of people sharing knowledge that is reflected in the names for plants, for example, because the names can be related and are borrowed from one group to another. You also have stories that have common themes, but might be, how can I say it, shifted or made appropriate for a given place. So, for example, there's a whole series of stories that are known sometimes as the Star Husband Tales about a woman or women who look up at the sky and they see a star and they want to be married to the star, or sometimes the star wants them to come up and they go up to sky country. And there they might be doing what they do on Earth, digging roots like camas. Here on Vancouver Island, the story goes with the camas digging. But in the north, it would be with the northern rice root. And on the prairies, it would be the prairie turnip. And then eventually they come back down to earth and they might be lowered down by cedar bark rope, or they might be lowered down by stinging nettle rope, or they might be lowered down by buffalo hide rope, depending on where you are. So the overall theme and the overall concepts are similar, but the specific details are very much based in that place where the language is situated.
Yeah, and that's what strikes me so much, is that this perspective, the language and epistemologies tie so much with ecology. And have you found that to be the case, that traditional ecological knowledge that, as you said, comes from spending generations and generations with an intimate connection with the other non-human organisms around them, do you find that then reflected in that language, that knowledge of kind of greater ecology? Does that weave its way throughout? Because that's my impression, my kind of uneducated impression about it.
Oh, absolutely. And you see it in the languages, in the ceremonial names for different salmon, for example, which pertain to relatives, uncle or cousin. And similarly, there's stories where alder is a tree, or and coyote is a human, has a human persona. And you see that with plants and with animals and even with fungi. They're seen as our close relatives, in other words, but very generous relatives and relatives with extreme supernatural powers, maybe more powerful than we humans are by quite a bit, and have the ability to help us as we need it. So in many of these cultures, humans are seen as a weaker element of life forms. So the plants and the animals are our helpers and supporters, and we need them much more than they need us.
That can't help but have a massive impact on how your society operates. Just thinking such an inverse to where we are today, where humans are always at the top of every decision, always at the top of whatever pyramid you're thinking of, is kind of humans are the center. So thinking that all these other organisms are more powerful than we are, what a massive shift. Another thing I'm struck by is that anthropomorphism. And I know that's something that in, and I don't want to generalize, but in modern scientific circles, there's always a hesitancy to anthropomorphize things. Do you think that helps us generate this more intimate connection and maybe help us find our place in the natural world? Because that's the impression I get from hearing this, is that these are people who definitely felt like they were part of nature and they had a relationship with everything around them and they didn't see themselves as separate. Do you think that this anthropomorphizing and assigning those kind of traits to non-human organisms helps us have a better relationship with them?
Well, absolutely. It gives us that relationship, a very special connection. And in fact, if we think even in science, it's recognized that all life is related. We all share the same general DNA structure and so forth. And so we are indeed relatives. But what this does, the perspective of relationships or relationality with other, our relatives, our non-human relatives, is it creates respect towards them that in mainstream society we seem to have forgotten. I remember being out in an old growth forest with a logger from one of the big logging companies, and he looked up at this big, huge Douglas fir and said, "Look at that mother." And he wasn't talking about mother in the relational sense at all. Right. He was talking about this as a thing that he was challenged to cut down. So it's quite a different kind of thinking if you look up at that tree and think, this is my grandmother, this is my ancient ancestor, or this is my relative who will help me if I need help. And you get a different way. Yes, we need to use all of those things. We need the plants. We need the animals to live ourselves. But we have a different feeling towards them. They're not just things. And we treat them with gratitude and appreciation and respect. And we don't wantonly waste them or just, we never think of hunting them for trophies for our wall, for example. Or cutting down a tree just to leave most of it on the ground.
And I know there are so many people listening like myself that just resonate so much more with that perspective and feel almost nourished and almost safer in our environment with that understanding. It becomes something much easier to relate to and interact with. And I think that's why so many people find hope there, is that that kind of perspective, even if the English language doesn't have the epistemology, maybe right now, maybe that'll evolve, to describe these relationships and describe, you know, just having those concepts suddenly as a guiding principle or as a perspective seems like such a great hope to us navigating forward. It seems like one of the only hopes. And that's where I want to bring in this idea that these traditions are still with us. You know, how do, from your research, and again, qualifying, these are groups that you've worked with, you're not speaking for all Indigenous peoples, but from the groups you worked with, how do they continue these living traditions and continue kind of holding down these perspectives in a society that is so drastically diverging from them?
Yeah, I need to say right off, I cannot speak for any of my Indigenous colleagues or friends at all. Yeah. I'm a student of theirs, and I've learned from them. And I share the knowledge that they've shared with me with permission. But I can't say that I'm speaking for them. Now I've lost the track of your question there, because I just wanted to make that point.
I think that's a really important qualification. And actually, you just bring up another great topic, that is that idea of permission and that letting these groups decide who to share this knowledge with and these perspectives with, to what extent. But, you know, from your experience, again, as someone who's really a student of this culture, you know, how do you see them successfully maintaining these perspectives and ceremonies, you know, when modern society seems to be diverging so far from these principles?
Yeah. Yes, it's been really, really hard. I would say, looking back on the last 100, 150 years on the West Coast since the settlers arrived, and there's been so many impacts, so many changes, a tsunami of changes that have taken place. Some of them have been maybe beneficial, but a lot of them have not been beneficial. And we've just heard there's been a lot recently about the residential schools and the horror that many children suffered being forced to go to residential schools. But there's also the sadness of the families left behind when their children are taken away, and the grandparents and parents aren't able to teach them what they know and pass that knowledge on. And that's equally horrible for people. Often when the children have come home, they've been almost brainwashed to say that they're not allowed to speak their language, right. They're not allowed to eat their traditional food is bad. And I've heard this from elders who've told me what happened when they came home. They didn't want to eat their traditional food anymore. And imagine how hurtful that is for their families. So there's the residential schools alone have created this gap, but also the alienation or the taking away of people's traditional lands and territories, the different regulations that were put upon people, not to allow fish traps anymore, which are actually a very sustainable way of caring for the fisheries and looking after them, not just harvesting fish, but monitoring them and keeping track of them and making sure that enough get up the rivers and so forth. But fish traps were banned. And the same with the use of fire. And the same with harvesting strips of bark from a tree. All of these things were banned. And those are part of the traditional life ways and practices of people. So there's so many different ways that this rich knowledge system and passing it along were disrupted across generations. And yet through all of that, there are people today who are extremely knowledgeable, and they manage to retain that knowledge through all of that negativity and all of the things that have happened to them, because someone cared, mostly grandparents and parents, aunts and uncles, who retained that knowledge retained the language, and managed to get enough of it to the next generation that we have people today who remember a great deal and carry it on. But it has to be done with people having the ability to get out on the lands and waters of their homelands and to actually be able to practice this knowledge. It can't be taught just in books. You have to do it. That's what I've heard elders say. You have to be out there. You have to do it. That makes the land base so important for people, which is why there's a great deal of work being done to reconnect people with their land bases and to have rights to their traditional territories. And I just want to mention, there's one elder that I've been working with a lot. His name is Lus Cheem, Dr. Arvid Charlie from the Cowichan Nation. And this week we'll have a book coming out, Lus Cheem's Plants. And it's the result of Lus Cheem sharing his knowledge with me and others over a period of decades. And he's one who was trained as a child by his great-grandfather, whose name was Lus Cheem, and by his father and his grandfather and grandmother, his father and his mother. And now he, in turn, as an elder who's training his children and grandchildren about this rich knowledge system. So I'm really happy to have had a small part in documenting Lus Cheem's knowledge, and it will be coming out this coming week.
What an honor and a privilege that must be. And just hearing about that history of basically cultural suppression, so many things come back to land in human existence, so that dispossession of land makes it so hard for a culture to continue, traditions to be passed down. And like I said, so many people, when they hear about this perspective, see it as this ray of hope for getting us out of so many of the problems we've created. Just such a paradoxical thing to hear that this has been suppressed and shut out, when so many of us know that this is the way and hope that we can learn and adapt these things into our own lives. And, you know, you being someone like that example with Lus Cheem's book, being someone who's trying to record and keep this knowledge, but as someone who, as you said, is not directly part of this community, how have you been able to balance, or how important has it been for you, or how have you successfully been able to learn from these cultures, but at the same time balance things like permission and make sure that you're doing it in the most authentic, reciprocal way possible? I mean, as someone who is a record keeper of this knowledge, what have you found to be successful in terms of receiving and recording this knowledge without the people's feeling like they're being dispossessed of knowledge? And then broadening, maybe we can learn from that as a society, how do you think this knowledge will disseminate out? You know, I laid out that utopian vision where this kind of perspective is what's going to save us, but, you know, do we deserve it? Or, you know, who gets to decide how much of that knowledge we get access to? You know, these are very kind of tricky concepts, but as someone who's worked directly in that role, I thought you may have some thoughts or things you've learned to successfully work with these peoples and understand and receive that knowledge without them feeling like, again, that you're dispossessing or taking something.
Sometimes I call it a mutual love of plants, because I have a background in love of plants, and I know that the people I work with do as well. And that's a common ground for us right away. But also, it's respect. Respect is so important. Appreciation and listening is very important. I've learned these over time. I've had some amazing teachers over the years who have instructed me and guided me. And I appreciate them all so much. There's a lot in Lus Cheem's Plants that is not published. So the book is his plant knowledge, but Lus Cheem also holds a great body of knowledge of spiritual practices relating to plants and environments that he doesn't share because it's not appropriate to share with somebody like myself. And so it's a matter of just respect, listening, being guided, asking permission, of course. And yeah. I'm sure I've made mistakes. The people that I've worked with have always been so kind and generous, and they allow some mistakes to be made and will guide me and correct me if needed. I also should mention that I've worked closely with many linguists, that is language specialists, who specialize in the knowledge of these different languages. And so often it's a three-way collaboration, so that I have the kind of the Western botanical knowledge and understanding, and the indigenous knowledge holder and the linguist, we all kind of collaborate to make sure that the information is documented accurately, the names are spelled properly, because I'm not a trained linguist, and that's yet it's really important to have these recorded properly. And I want to acknowledge so many of the elders that I've worked with. Another one that who passed away in 2018, Kwaksistalawatla, Clan Chief Adam Dick from the Kwakwaka'wakw Tsawadenuk Nation. He was a dear, dear friend and teacher for many years, and his wife, Kimrakalmaklutisi Okwalokwa, is still living in just north of here. And I still am working with her and with another friend, Dr. Doug Durr in Oregon. We've been working for years now documenting Kwaksistala's knowledge about so many different things, fisheries, and but also ceremonies. And in particular, he was like some of the others, like Luschim, but he was singled out as a baby, as someone who needed to be taught about the traditional ceremonies and knowledge. And he also he was kept away from residential school. When the police came to take the children away to school, they hid him away. And so he spent time, he never learned to read or write English, but he spent time growing up with his grandparents and his parents in remote areas. And he went with his grandmother and mother down to the root gardens at the estuary of the Kingcome River and learned how to cultivate the Tequilac root gardens with the Tahsus, the springbank clover, and the Hukum, the rice root, and the Tlaksam, the silverweed, and the Kweni, the Nootka Lupin, and how they looked after those root gardens and tended them every year and so forth. And he passed along that knowledge to me and to our students. And we had, for many years, we had what we called Adam's School, where we would go and spend time with Adam and go out on the land with Adam and Kim and learn from him. And that was such a special opportunity for me. But I've had many, many times of going out with elders out on the land, picking berries or digging roots for basketry or many other things, even picking mushrooms, going out with my friend Harriet Kuhnlein, who's a nutritionist, and Hilda Austin, an elder from the village of Lytton, which you've probably heard had a terrible fire this year and the whole village burned down. But Hilda was from that village, and she took us out to the Nicola Valley and taught us about harvesting the cottonwood mushroom, Tricholoma populinum, and how she did it using a stick to kind of shift the mounds of cottonwood leaves in the fall and find the clusters of cottonwood mushrooms under the leaves, and then take the skin, you tap them with the top of a knife, and all the sand comes out from the gills, and then you peel the caps and you cut them from the stems, and you fry the stems and the caps in oil, and they are truly the best mushroom I've ever tasted. And that was with Hilda Austin, and she taught us so many other things as well. I could just go on and on about the elders that I've had the privilege of knowing and working with over the years, because they've all been so special, and many of them I still keep in touch with their families, and still just I can hear their voices all the time.
I mean, what a special opportunity, and I appreciate you sharing that, you know, what that journey has been like for you, because I know for people like myself, again, we find so much hope. We want to learn all this knowledge. I want this tradition. And it's almost like some kind of greedy child. You know, I expect someone to feed me all this knowledge. There's that process, though, of deference and respect to the knowledge holders, that they will give out the knowledge. And likely they're making decisions on what you're ready for, what's appropriate. But it sounds like even for what those who have been holders of this knowledge, even the what they feel like they are able to share, the kind of what I'm going to call the children of modernity. I mean, maybe it's the children of Western Europe that came to this land, but what they've been willing to share still would have a massive impact on how we organize, how we relate to environments. So I think, you know, we don't need to know it all to still have a massive shift and how our society operates for the better. And then I was going to ask for specific examples of any mushrooms or plants, and you've given us some beautiful ones. But just this idea of managing landscapes, from your experience, the elders and groups that you've worked with, would it be fair to say that these practices are really the origins of things like permaculture, agroforestry? From what you've seen, I mean, are we talking about wide-scale ecosystem management with a much subtler hand than what we're used to when we think of farming?
Yeah, absolutely. I often have thought that the management systems that First Nations have are very similar to permaculture, because at least here in northwestern North America, the plant resources that people have used traditionally are all perennials. There are very few annuals that people grow. Maybe tobacco is one, but in most cases, the plant resources are either trees or shrubs or perennial herbaceous plants, or seaweed, for example, or mushrooms that come back year after year. And so the techniques that are used to maintain them, they go with a word that Kwaksistalawatla taught us, Doug Duer and myself, that means keeping it living. And so Doug and I edited a book that's called Keeping It Living, published by University of Washington Press. And those words imply so much. It means that the techniques that people use, you partially harvest from the trees, you take a strip of bark, you don't girdle the tree, you take a branch of a yew tree to make a wedge, you don't cut down the tree. Or if you do need to cut down the tree, you have a special relationship with it, and you go and you talk to the tree and ask permission to take it down and explain that you want to transform it into a canoe or something like that. The herbaceous perennials, like the stinging nettle used for twine, for example, it grows in patches, and people would transplant the best stinging nettles to their village sites so they'd have access to it and could harvest it year after year from the original root. Berry bushes were pruned and tended. Sometimes hazelnuts were burned to the ground so they'd shoot up, and they could use the shoots for basket rims. Same with Saskatoon berries, or service berries we call them. And then a few years afterwards, they're really productive in terms of their nuts or their fruit that they provide. Crab apples were locked at the top a little bit so people could reach the fruit. And they had stands, orchards of crab apples. And one of my friends, colleagues, former students, Chelsea Armstrong, has just published a paper on the forest gardens of the Skeena River area and how there are places there in different places around British Columbia, and I'm sure in California too, where there's whole suites of culturally valued plants that are growing together, where the people have created the right environment for them, sometimes transplanted them there, not only stinging nettle, but rice root, maybe wild ginger, even berry bushes transplanted to particular places, hazelnut. In fact, the hazelnut story is a really interesting one because if you look at a map of distribution of hazelnut, it's common on the southern interior of BC. There's a few populations on Vancouver Island, and then there's none for a little bit. And then if you look up on the Skeena River in northern BC, there's a little area where there are a lot of hazelnuts. In fact, there's a village, Hazelton, that's named after hazelnuts on the Skeena River. And if you look at the names, the indigenous names for hazelnut, there's a word, tsik, that means nut or seed in Proto-Salish, in the ancestral Salish language. And guess what? The Giksan, Niska, and Tsimshian Tsimalik name for hazelnut has got the word tsik in it. So it means that these languages that aren't related to Salish, but they have a Proto-Salish word for hazelnut in their languages, which indicates a possible translocation of the nuts long ago. It would have happened a long time ago up into the Skeena by humans. It's still just a theory, but there's fairly good evidence. That same word, tsik, by the way, in the Shwetmuk language, in the Shuswap language, it's used for white bark pine seed. And the Tsilkotin also have the same, a word with the same derivation in their language. And there's a different language family again. So it's interesting to see how that you can use the language to understand the history of where these plants are. But anyway, going back to the tending of plants and the idea of permaculture, we have many examples of how people maintained the camas beds, harvested them by the millions, but they still maintained very heavy populations of camas by the way that they harvested them and maintained the young bulbs to grow for the next generation and so forth. And the use of fire as well to maintain prairies and openings and early successional stages where berries really thrive, where deer like to graze and so forth. So there are all these different ways that people looked after their resources and managed them in a very comprehensive and holistic way. So it wasn't just like a monoculture at all.
Yeah, and it feels like the definition of stewardship, and it feels like this blend of artistry and working with landscape, a supreme amount of ecological knowledge of how things should go together and understanding seasonality. For me, that's kind of the pinnacle, it would seem like, of farming, where you can work well enough with a natural ecology to help support it and then produce the food that you and the people that live there need. There's something so deeply satisfying about how holistic that system seems. And it gets back to, again, this idea of getting these groups, these people who are still holding this knowledge, still living these traditions, access to land.
Yeah.
And that's another part of your work that I wanted to cover, because you've studied ideas of governance, land ownership. I mean, what models are there for how, in its most simplified sense, how can we get these groups, these indigenous groups that have traditional ecological knowledge, access to the land where their knowledge is based out of? Because obviously a lot of this knowledge is centered around geographic areas where they understand the plant life, the fungi life, the seasons. How do we get them access to that land to engage in these practices and thereby be the way showers and give an example to everyone else of what's possible. I mean, in your research, what does that look like? Because I can't imagine, it seems horrific to think that we need to have people buy this land. I mean, is there a way, as I wrote in my notes, is there a way to like cede back these lands to sovereign peoples? Can we realize that what we did wasn't right and we need to kind of give this back? I mean, what does that complex relationship look like?
Yeah, it is complex for sure. And one of the areas that I've been working in the last few decades, I guess, is in Indigenous people's land rights and title, especially here in British Columbia. There weren't very many treaties signed in the early days, and a lot of the land was taken away without any proper arrangement and without any agreement with the First Nations whose territories were being encroached on. And now we have this whole area of legal rights and title to lands that are being considered right now with the new treaties. And there have been some that have been signed with the Crown, with the British Columbia and Canada. And there are others that are still ongoing in various forms. Some are in negotiations and some have gone to court. It's just so complex. But other people are working on other models, I guess, for how people can access their lands and their traditional lands and resources without necessarily the title of ownership, but with rights to access and rights to use certain resources. And so there's all these different models that are being followed. And one of my most recent edited books is called Plants, People, and Places. And it's looking at the role of ethnobotany and ethnoecology in affirming Indigenous people's land rights and title. And so there are chapters in there written a lot by Indigenous people, scholars, and also lawyers that talk about these very complex issues. And I've been a part of that to some extent in serving as a witness in some of the court cases. That's another area that ethnobotany can contribute to raising the profile of plants as being important, because often they're overlooked in these discussions. There's a greater focus on hunting and fishing, we could say, on the knowledge that is primarily from men, and often women's knowledge about the access to say berries or basket materials and things like that is often overlooked or has been. And so bringing those to a higher profile is really important, I think. I wanted to tell you a quick story talking about Kwaksistalawatla and keeping it living. One of the things that really raised my awareness of how this perennial cultivation works is talking with Kwaksistalawatla. And he was talking about the hukum, the rice root, the northern rice root, which is Fritillaria camchatensis, named after the Kamchatka Peninsula, where it is also used. Anyways, he was saying, yeah, that was my job as a boy. He was with his grandmother and mother down in the estuarine root gardens, the Tequilac root gardens. He said, that was my job when I was a kid, to pull the gagump off the bottom of the hukum and put it back in the soil. And I thought, what? What's that? What's gagump? And then he said, gagump means grandfather. And so I said, well, Adam, is that gagump? Is that going to grow into a new plant? He said, yeah, that's why we did it. He didn't say, you dummy, but, you know, it was obvious to him. Yeah, that's why we did it. So his job as a 9-10-year-old kid was to go follow his mother and grandmother and take the little sprout. I didn't know what it was when he told me, but we up in Kingcome, he showed me what it was. It's a little sprout maybe 2-3 year old sprout that if you put it back in the ground within a couple of years, it's going to grow into a full-sized rice root bulb. And so the very same year, that would be back in the early 1990s, that very same year, I was up working in the Shuswap or Shwetmuk area with a wonderful woman, the late Dr. Mary Thomas. She was a Shwetmuk woman from Enderby and Nisqually in Salmon Arm. And she was talking about a root that her family harvested called Shwich, which is the yellow glacier lily. And she said, yeah, we would be up on the hillside digging, and my mom and my grandma would take off this little part at the bottom called, we called it the whiskers, she said. They'd make a little pile, and they'd put it back in the soil when we're digging. She said, and when we bring the bulbs, the shwich bulbs back to camp, they'd be cleaning them, and they'd make a little pile of the whiskers. And the next day, they'd take them back up and plant them where they harvested. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is something new. I'd never heard about this. I'd never seen anybody talk about it before. Of the idea of two people of totally different language groups in totally different areas, one of them talking about a root that grows in the tidal marsh, and one a root that grows in the subalpine meadows around Nisqually, but doing exactly the same thing to two different edible root plants in the lily family, and that was to replant the propagules. And more I've recognized that the harvesting methods that people use are really important, leaving fragments of the rhizomes or roots in the ground to regrow and reshoot. It's part of perennial cultivation. And so you never have to actually sow seeds. But when you're harvesting camas, for example, you do it when the plants have gone to seed, and you're knocking the seeds into the ground that's been turned up and stirred up. Then you do a quick burn over the area, and that creates ash that falls into the crevices of the recently dug soil and gives a shot of fertilizer to the bulbs and the newly sprouting seeds. I mean, it's a really amazing and complex system that was never recognized before. By outsiders, I should say. Of course, the people themselves knew perfectly well what they were doing.
Well, and until you elucidated it and related it back to maybe a more traditional cultivation process, that suddenly I see, oh yeah, those steps, that wasn't random. Those are very intentional, very efficient ways to cultivate a landscape. And also get these amazing anthropological implications for, is there some kind of perennial cultivation discipline that is so, so ancient? I think that's the obvious implication, is so ancient that eventually disseminated as culture separated and peoples moved, they carried that knowledge with them. Like, this is maybe a quintessential part to being human, or being a successful human in your landscape, is understanding something like perennial cultivation.
Yeah, I think so. And that's, it drives me crazy when people talk about hunter-gatherers. Gatherers seem such a put-down to me. It doesn't really reflect the richness of the knowledge and the practices that go with harvesting and perpetuating the plant resources that people use. And again, it's often, well, we know there are books out, Man the Hunter, Woman the Gatherer. It's sort of like putting down such a rich system of knowledge to just something really trivial.
I love that. Gatherer is too much of a put down, that we're talking about high level perennial cultivation.
Yeah. Yeah. That goes on for over generations.
And I guess this gets to something else I wanted to bring up, because you are someone who is trained classically as, you know, in Western plant physiology and Western science, and now having learned from elders of an indigenous tradition, this different ecological perspective, what just seems like a much more holistic perspective and intimate relationship with nature. As a bridge between that, how do these concepts marry together? And, you know, maybe looking out in the coming years, how do these concepts dovetail together? And then how do you hope that they're able to marry these concepts? Because I think there's so much valid from both.
That's a great question. To me, indigenous knowledge systems or traditional ecological knowledge systems are so much broader than Western science in terms of what they encompass, what they cover. I would say they're more equivalent to all of the different departments that you'd find at a university. So they encompass philosophy. They encompass education. They encompass political science and governance systems, ways of making decisions, and so forth, not just what we would call the original sciences, biology, chemistry, and physics, but so much more. And I think that's the failing of Western science. It's not the Western science itself, which is really important and is uncovered so much knowledge and is amazing, and it's what has been accomplished with Western science. But Western science doesn't incorporate governance and decision making. And also, indigenous knowledge is multi-generational. It has a deep grounding and base for it. And it looks into the future. What's it going to be like 7 generations from now? That's what our governance systems need to do. Our politicians need to think about not just, immediate what's happening right now, but make decisions as if they matter to the next 7 generations. And often we find short-term decisions that are made based on short-term gains without the recognition of the long-term. And this is the trap that we found ourselves in with climate change now, because nobody was willing to make those long-term decisions about what we should do and where we should go. They make them based on the immediate, what's going to happen in the next 4 years and in an election cycle. And I think that's a huge difference between indigenous knowledge systems and the Western science, is that governance and education components, and also the relationality and the different relationship that people have with other species that we don't seem to really fully recognize in Western mainstream culture.
And you're naturally going to have a society out of balance with its environment if knowledge of ecology is kind of cordoned off under this banner of science that, like you're saying, doesn't suffuse the rest of culture. And I think so many of us, especially nowadays, we're left with a lot of questions about where are we going? What are we doing? And I know so many people are trying to find some root, some guiding principle that at the basic level, it's that question people have wrestled with for time immemorial. As humans, what are we doing here? What are we trying to? And this, or at least the pieces of this understanding that you've brought back from working directly with these groups, how some of this knowledge has started to kind of disseminate into our culture, this feels much more like a root or a core of what it is to be human. That yes, to develop these intimate relationships with ecology, have an intimate understanding of nature, and then that just is the framework on which you build culture and philosophy. You know, we were talking before about how is language and ecology connected, and they're deeply intertwined. And now you're kind of broadening my perspective on this, that ecology and this understanding of natural systems was intertwined in seemingly all facets of life. And if your society is based on that, then you're naturally going to have a more harmonious relationship with that system and feel like it's a part of it. So maybe that's the big lesson we have to learn, is to allow these insights and these perspectives to suffuse and affect how we make decisions in all these other arenas and stop kind of separating everything.
Yeah, I think as a society, we also have to reconsider what is truly important in life. You know, is it important to have a great big truck to drive up and down the highway at high speeds? Or is it important to have fresh air and songbirds around you and butterflies and have good, clean food and so forth? There are different choices that we make based on what is important to us. And I think we've been making some bad choices in that regard.
When you stray from that greater ecological perspective, and that's why I love thinking about mushrooms so much. This wave of interest in mushrooms and mycology has pushed people like myself more into the realms of understanding these perspectives. Everything is interconnected. And suddenly it becomes really obvious that yes, clean air, healthy birds, bees, way more important than a truck or any kind of bauble of modernity. And I see a lot of hope for people kind of grasping this. But for you as a researcher, what do you see the future of that dissemination of indigenous knowledge into the mainstream? I know that, again, is a massive question I'm laying at your feet. Mm-hmm. But with the success of books like your books, like Braiding Sweetgrass, which I've had about 10 people this week tell me that they've started reading, you know, as these concepts become more popular and as people that are starving for this kind of sensible, sustainable way of seeing the world kind of find this information and this set of indigenous wisdom, or at least the pieces that we have, what do you see that future? I mean, and again, with the backdrop of the living people embodying these traditions aren't obliged to share this with us and save us from, you know, our own destruction potentially. But how do you see that future?
Well, I think more and more I see First Nations, Indigenous people having their own voice. And we hear it more and more on the radio, on CBC, and different programs. There are many more Indigenous scholars who are at universities teaching about their own background, their own knowledge and languages and so forth. And some of them, I'm proud to say, are people who were formerly my students, who are either getting their PhDs or have their PhDs now, and they're out there sharing their knowledge and their perspectives, and that's as it should be. But they also, I think it's important to have allies and people who really want to learn and understand and to make a difference. And so we all have a role to play in that. We all have an obligation to learn what we can. And it's set out in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People and even the Convention on Biological Diversity and various other international level laws that we are signatory to in Canada, and I think in the US you are as well. And so, yeah, I think it's something that we all need to work towards, but we need to make sure that we do everything we can to for First Nations, Indigenous peoples to have their own voice and to be able to speak for themselves and share what they really see as important.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a backdrop of all of this that we haven't gone over, you talked about the residential schools and the suppression of culture, is that history of what is basically invasion and genocide of people already living here. And it just makes you wonder about that future of how stable a society can be when you are basically the conquerors who've committed horrible acts, realizing your conscience is finally kicking in and you're realizing what you've done, what's been lost. You know, that's such a mystery on how to navigate that space, what that future is going to look like. You know, like I said before, is that the kind of thing where we can just cede land back to Indigenous cultures? I always wonder if that's a step that would ever be possible, because inevitably, that would seem like the right thing to do, not only for those cultures and peoples, but probably for the planet. That's probably the only hope we have left, is to give back these lands and let people engage in these practices that on kind of a spiritual or metaphysical level are balancing the earth and kind of harmonizing the energies that happen on the earth. So I'm glad to hear that you see that this is starting to disseminate. People are getting more of a voice, and it will be fascinating to see how we reconcile that relationship. Our conscience is kicking in. We're understanding what we've lost, and how we negotiate that is probably going to be the tale of the future of this country, really. I think at the heart of it, at the heart of where we think we're going to go, or what outcome this grand experiment of migrants has been, is going to largely rest on how we reconcile that relationship.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think there's some good examples and good models to follow. And some of the First Nations leaders, we've heard about two-eyed seeing, we've heard about, you know, we're all in the canoe together, and we all have to work at these solutions and find ways in a good way to honor each other and just to honor the earth and to understand that we can't live without our relatives, the natural world, the plants and animals that are our relatives. We have to look after them. And if we all accept that and decide what's important in life, I think we can get there.
And what a simple and powerful step. Understand that all the non-human organisms around you are still your relatives, your friends and family. And, you know, overnight, we'll see this world being treated a lot differently. You know, where can people find your work, Professor Turner? You know, where is the best place? Obviously, you've got dozens of books. Your book, Ancient Pathways, like I said in the introduction, is an opus. If people are interested in any of these concepts, get Ancient Pathways, dive in and do the research. But where can people find your work and maybe connect with you if they're really interested in these topics?
Well, I still have my university connection. I'm retired from the University of Victoria, but their bookstore carries most of my books, I think, that are in print. The Royal BC Museum as well. And local bookstores would order books as well if they're still in print. So McGill Queen's University Press published Ancient Pathways, and also our new book, the newer book, Plants, People, and Places. And some of my books are handbooks from the Royal British Columbia Museum. And Timber Press published a book on poisonous plants and mushrooms of North America, two different issues of that, and University of Washington Press. So, but bookstores know how to order these things, and they could get them in for you.
Well, we'll put links to as many of the books as we can fit in the show notes, and obviously the links to your website, everything like that. And obviously, you're someone with an incredible body of work, decades of research. Are there any future plans or anything on the horizon for you, maybe big questions you're looking at, anthropological, ethnobotanical, ethnomycological questions you want to research? What are the future plans for you?
Just to continue on learning, I'm hoping to, I will keep in touch with as many of my First Nations friends and colleagues, and we still have some graduate students on whose committees I serve, so I want to make sure and support them and just to do the best that I can to, in collaboration with First Nations and with other colleagues, and continue learning. I'll be a student for my whole life. It's really fun to learn.
What a powerful reminder for all of us. If Professor Turner has a lot to learn, then we need to all stay open and constantly be learning. But yes, I love that answer. My wife likes to say a life of questing is a life of asking questions. So we need to keep learning, keep asking good questions, That may be the path to some kind of fulfillment.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to wrap things up then with the three questions that I like to ask all of my guests. And the first of which is a mushroom or fungus that you love and why. And this could be something you love to eat, something you love to look at, or something that was a particularly potent story in your anthropological research. But a mushroom or fungus that you love and why.
Well, I have to say the cottonwood mushroom, Tricholoma populinum. Having gone out with Hilda Austin and learned about it, a mushroom that I'd never heard of before, suddenly, I have to also tell a quick story that Mabel Jo, another Nkatmuk elder, gave me a jar of mushrooms when one of my children was born. And she said, when your baby is just a few weeks old, you open this jar of mushrooms. You can eat the mushrooms, but you wash your baby in the juice of these mushrooms. And that will make her strong and independent. Because mushrooms are they're soft, but they're very strong. They can push rocks aside when they're growing. They can split logs open when they're growing. And so that was a tradition that Nkatmuk mothers would do with their babies. So I did that. And yes, my daughter's strong and independent, I have to say. Ever since then, when I saw Mabel, she would say, and how is my little Kekmus? Kamish is the name for mushroom, and Kekmus means little mushroom. So that was her nickname for my baby.
If there's no other takeaway anyone who's a parent out there has from this episode, it is that your little one should be bathed in mushroom water to be made strong and independent. What a fantastic story and a fantastic ritual. And that's another reason for anyone who's interested in this. If you want to hear more of those stories as well as the knowledge, you have to go read the books and check out Professor Turner's work because it's amazing, full of things like that. And then the second question, I'm going to adapt a little bit, and that is, what has this relationship that you've developed with traditional ecological knowledge and the indigenous groups and colleagues you've worked with, you know, what has that given to you? And we've heard all those different insights throughout the episode, but as a summation, you know, what has that relationship given to you and really changed your life?
Truly. It's enriched my life and the life of my family so much. And I almost come to tears when I think about the elders who have been my teachers and friends over so many years. And most of them now have passed away because I've been working for over 50 years. And yet they're still with me in my heart. I can still see their faces. I can hear their voices. I can take myself back to where we are out in the bush or laughing about some joke or just having fun learning about plants together, berry picking and so forth, or harvesting plants for medicine. And so they've made my life, along with, of course, my own family, my husband, who I've been married to for over 52 years, and all
Incredible.
Of my other family. But they've certainly been a really, really important and dear part of my life. And I love them dearly.
Yeah, it's really hearing your stories and just about the nature of your work. You can imagine that would be all-encompassing. I mean, you ask a question like, what's the impact? How has it changed you? It's like, yeah, how about entire life, you know, entire life course? Yeah. So yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And then the final question is something I asked before, but just a slight change to it. What is your highest hopes for how our modern societies will be changed by this growing recognition of traditional ecological knowledge, of the living indigenous traditions that still exist here today? I mean, what's your highest hopes for how that shapes modern society moving forward? You know, maybe it is we give, like I said, give all the land back. But for you, what's maybe the most beneficial future that you see there?
Respect for the natural world, for the different ecosystems and habitats that we all depend on and that our non-human relatives depend on. So, you know, what really hurts is to see a TV ad of a big truck driving through a desert or through a wetland or something with no regard for the driver, having no regard for the well-being of those habitats and the other species that depend on them. And so I hope that it will change people's attitudes about what's important in life and make them more careful and caring of the habitats that we depend on, the wetlands, the deserts, the forests, and to think about them as, you know, living entities that support us with gratitude and respect.
And it can't happen soon enough. You know, all political machinations aside, all, you know, wherever you fall on your spectrum of beliefs, it's undeniable that as a society, we've gotten away from the homeostasis with our environment and the health of our ecology being at the center of our society. And I think everyone can see that that hasn't been for our benefit and certainly not the planet's benefit. So yes, I pray that what you're saying comes true sooner rather than later. And you know, we kind of pick up the phone and get the message here that these cultures are still trying to share with us. Professor Turner, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing amazing stories, some of the best stories I've ever heard, amazing stories, knowledge, perspectives that you've gotten from a lifetime of work and research. It's really been an honor to speak with you. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. It's been fun. Thank you.